Okay, good morning, everybody. Thanks for getting up here so early, despite the fact that we had a little running around going on here to figure out which room we were actually in. So I have about 15 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about an environmental justice screening method that we have been in the process of developing for several years that I think is applicable to informing efforts to think about school siting. It was not necessarily originally intended for that. It was it could inform siting, environmental regulatory decision making about permitting, all kinds of things. So it has a variety of applications to decision making contexts. And so I'm hoping that we can stimulate some discussion about how well or poorly it works in the school siting context. So I just want to talk a little bit about some of the scientific evidence that informed our design of this, and then what are the implications and how it's been used in the past. So I think I just want to give a little context here and to say that the environmental justice movement itself, I think, has forced regulatory science to get better in the sense of that it's really forced both academic scientists and others to really think very clearly and hard about how we do a better job of considering the role of social inequality and its links to environmental health disparities, and to really move away from chemical by chemical, facility by facility regulation to take into account that, you know, people are really exposed to multiple hazards, and that there's certain communities are more vulnerable to the toxic effects of pollution, in part because of the social stressors that they're living with every day in different environments, whether we're talking about material deprivation, chronic malnutrition, and chronic health problems. So when we're talking about cumulative impacts, you know, I always think photos say about 1,000 words. And so I've done a lot of work here in Richmond, California, in this community here, known as Liberty and Atchison Villages. It was on the fence line of the largest oil refinery west of the Mississippi. And it has a lot of other sources of particularly air pollution, but also there are a lot of Superfund sites around here, and it has major transportation corridors. So this is where people live, and these are the kinds of things that motivate us to think about how we start screening so we don't end up with situations like this anymore, and maybe we try and remediate the ones that we have. This is another example of cumulative impacts in LA. This is a major transportation corridor that links the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach to the rest of the country, essentially. And this is where all the trucks and stuff come with the containers to and from the ports. It's the whole goods movement corridor. And you can see what the neighbors think about that. And then this is another example of incompatible land uses here. Okay, so what's the science tell us about cumulative impacts? The first assertion, I think, is that, and in terms of epidemiological and environmental health science, is that disparities in exposures exist, and that certain groups, demographic and socioeconomic, bear a disproportionate burden of exposures and health risks associated with environmental hazards. So this is just looking at the Bay Area. This data is pretty old, actually, but this is just looking, I'm sorry, this looks like dollar signs as opposed to red dots on here, but these dollar signs are actually, well, maybe that's appropriate, the toxic release inventory facilities overlaid in terms of the proportion of residents in the San Francisco Bay Area, proportion of residents of color. So, and this was a quick and dirty analysis that basically shows that a lot of these large industrial facilities or neighborhoods that have predominantly residents of color are hosting them mostly. The other assertion is that social inequality can amplify the adverse health effects of environmental hazards. There's a lot of very good emerging science that really kind of backs this up, and this plays out both at the individual level, in terms of individual level measures of people's demographic or socioeconomic position, as well as area level measures. The neighborhood you live in can also enhance your vulnerability to the toxic effects of pollutants. So this is a study we recently did in California, looking at the relationship between ambient particulate matter exposure and risk of decreased average birth weight in the state of California. We looked at 10 years worth of birth data in the state, and this is looking at different kinds of particulate matter, PM10, PM2.5, which is smaller, and then coarse PM. And each one of these dots represents a different racial or ethnic group for the mother, as identified on the birth registry as she identifies herself. And as you can see, you definitely see effects of PM, different kinds of PM, in decreasing average birth weight for all mothers, but you see much stronger effects of the of PM on birth weight for African American mothers compared to the other racial and ethnic groups. So this is one way in which we can sort of back up the assertion that certain groups are definitely more vulnerable to the toxic effects of pollutants. We don't always know the mechanisms of that, but the evidence, this is just one example, consistently appears to back this up. So there's also, you know, the place-based inequalities and the stressors of where you live can also enhance your vulnerability. And this is a very interesting study that was done a little while ago looking at the relationship between traffic-related air pollution and a risk of a child being diagnosed for the first time with asthma. And what this study found was that kids who lived in neighborhoods where they were exposed to violence, they themselves had not personally experienced violence, but they lived in neighborhoods where they saw it, heard it, you know, shootings, fights, these kinds of things, that those kids were definitely, that relationship between traffic-related air pollution and risk of an asthma diagnosis was quite strong for kids who were living in neighborhoods where they were witnessing violence. And you didn't really see any relationship for kids who were not witnessing violence. So there's something about that psychosocial stress that appears to affect the immunological system and enhance vulnerability of kids to certain things. So I think this is relevant for the school context in that this is just a quick and dirty taste of the evidence. There's a lot more out there, and I can suggest papers to read, that we really need to be thinking about that the science is really playing catch-up to community wisdom on this question, and how do we translate what we know about the science of cumulative impacts into tools to promote policy action, even as the science is evolving, okay? Because we're always going to be in search for better and better science, but if our goal really is disease prevention and healthy kids, let's figure out what we can do now based on what we know and the data that we have. So we took on the charge. We got some funding by the California Air Resources Board, actually, to do this project where we wanted to create an environmental justice screening method. And it was designed to develop indicators of cumulative impact that could be applied to multiple uses, land use planning, regulatory decision making and enforcement, and community outreach and mobilization. It was designed for a variety of stakeholders, regulatory stakeholders to guide decision making, but also community stakeholders to inform organizing and advocacy. So we have been working on four categories of what we call cumulative impact. So these categories include proximity to hazards and sensitive land uses, okay, so a lot of the things that all three speakers have already been talking about, characterizing health risks and air pollution exposures. We were funded by the Air Resources Board, so we focused a lot on air. We're starting to look at other sources of pollution that are relevant to places in California, like pesticide use for the Central Valley. That's not reflected here right now. Metrics of social and health vulnerability, okay? So a lot of demographic information that we use to characterize neighborhoods, and I'll tell you that in about a second. And this new category, which we've just added, is climate change vulnerability, okay? So let me run through this fairly quickly. The one thing that we did was, I'm going to show you the example for LA. We have focused our screening on where we know people live or go to school or do something, where people are, okay? So we use land use data to basically carve out those pieces, okay, that we want to focus our screening on, okay? Things that are in dark gray are either very industrial where people are not hanging out or living, and or light gray is open space, and I'm sorry this isn't too visible. So you could have a very industrialized area that is not going to come up hot on our map, because there are not people living there, and they're not going to school there, and that's so, because you don't want those kinds of artifacts when you're doing this kind of screening. So just to give you an example, So we look at all this land use data, and I know this is very, like, a little complicated, but the idea is we try and carve out things like this. This is a cemetery, okay? There are no people living there, all right? So it doesn't really matter if there's a lot of hazardous facilities there. So we try and take these things into account. as we're parsing out the land use data. We overlay the land use polygons onto census blocks, and we get these land use polygons that are intersected with blocks, and we get these what we call cumulative impact polygons, which are associated with a specific block and land use. And then basically, this is fake, but each one of these gets ranked between 1 and 5 in terms of cumulative impacts. So let's look at the categories. The first category is sensitive land uses and hazards. So the sensitive land uses that we're looking at is, does a place have a school? Does it have a child care facility? Does it have urban playgrounds and parks? Is it a residential neighborhood? Does it have a senior housing facility? If the polygon hosts at least one of these, the polygon gets just a 1, a yes, no kind of thing. And the other thing is then we also add up the hazardous land uses in that area. From the publicly available databases that we have in California, we're fortunate to have quite a few, we define hazardous land uses pretty broadly, both looking at small area emitters, chrome platers, these kinds of things that are quote-unquote small but can have very localized impacts, and then land uses like rails, ports, airports, refineries, which are a big deal in California. And we use a weighting approach, which I'll provide you the paper. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I don't have the time, but here's a land use polygon, and we do kind of a weighted count of the different kinds of land uses. So the closer you are, the more this type of land use, this railway, is going to count much more than these facilities that are a longer buffer away. But we don't want to exclude them completely because they could still be having an impact. But we're weighting the ones that have a bigger buffer less than the ones that have a tighter buffer around our land use polygon. So that's how we're doing our count. So this is what the hazard proximity and sensitive land use map looks like. We do a count, and then we basically do a quintile scoring so you can see which ones are high, all right? And so red is bad and green is good. It's probably psychologically not such great color scheme to be using, but definitely drives home the point that there are certain areas. And as you can see, there are parts here that are gray because there aren't, in this section here, of while the ports definitely have neighborhoods near them here, this part of the ports doesn't have people living in them, so you wouldn't want this turning bright red when there aren't people there. Category 2 is health risk and exposure. So we're using EPA data, both looking at the risk screening environmental indicators data, which basically calculates hazard scores from toxic release inventory facilities. We use the National Air Toxics Assessment. We estimate respiratory hazards and estimated lifetime cancer risk. We actually include diesel in our assessments, which is something that EPA doesn't do because California has toxicity numbers for those. And we also use interpolated values for PM2.5 concentrations as well as ozone concentrations, which are big issues in our state. And this is what the map looks like for this layer. Okay, so you can see it's a little bit different depending on the kind of category that you're looking at. All right, the redness is very concentrated, for example, along major transportation corridors because this database really takes into account traffic-related air pollution. Social and health vulnerability metrics. This is our third category. These are the kinds of things that we're considering about neighborhoods. So socioeconomic status, these are ones that have been used a lot in previous environmental justice related research. Then we tried to get sort of neighborhood level metrics that would get at potential biological vulnerability. So what's the age distribution of people living in the neighborhoods? One health indicator that's available statewide at the census tract levels looking at poor birth outcomes, which is a proportion of preterm or small for gestational age infants. And then metrics, and this is when we were doing focus groups and stuff with community stakeholders, they want metrics of a community's capacity to engage politically. And so we use linguistic isolation and voter turnout as those metrics. And this is what the map looks like for this category. Okay, again, it's changed a little bit. This is just based on the social metrics. Finally, we look at climate change vulnerability. These are the metrics we're currently working with. We're trying to add to them, but we're looking at metrics of heat island risk, so tree canopy and impervious surface. We're looking at temperature, and we have projected mean temperature into the future as well as changes in projected mean temperature in the future. because, you know, places that have always been hot, people are acclimated to dealing with hot weather. But for those of us who live, for example, near the bay, if it gets hot, we all freak out and don't really know what to do. And we get sick and we lay in the hospital because we don't know how to behave appropriately. And then you have some metrics of mobility and social isolation. Okay, got to get going here. Just to give you a sense of, like, tree canopy distribution, you can see that there's pretty significant racial disparities here, that neighborhoods that are predominantly have residents of color have a lot less tree canopy than neighborhoods that have much fewer residents of color, that tend to have more tree canopy throughout the state. So this is what the map looks like in terms of climate change vulnerability. For LA, this is a lot more widespread because LA has a big heat island problem that's pretty across the board. But there's still a lot of variation within that, but a lot of it's quite red. LA has a tree planting impervious surface problem. Okay, and then the beauty of this is that you can look at the categories separately, peel off those layers like I just showed you, and then you can combine them and have a combined score. This is what the map looks like when you combine all of those four categories together and score them, and you get sort of a cumulative impacts score to really get a sense of where you might want to target your interventions to address these kinds of things. So we are in the process of trying to apply this to characterize school sites. How do we score schools with the neighborhood context in mind? And we're playing with also scoring schools with the neighborhood context as well as the school context in mind, because we can have access to a lot of very good demographic information about the school itself, classroom size, and these kinds of things. So I think its applicability for school siting is quite relevant. And LA has been the epicenter, as Steve talked about, of some pretty significant school siting fights. We've done a lot of just ground truthing of our results with community-based and environmental health and environmental justice organizations. People walking, validating the location of the hazardous facilities that we've identified and sensitive land uses. Also trying to identify sensitive land uses that databases may not capture. This is a very nice report that's available online. You can just Google hidden hazards and find it. This is the result of our ground truthing effort of our screening method. These are the places where we did ground truthing. This is the team that required to do all that ground truthing of all those locales. And just to show you the kind of what I'm talking about in terms of ground truthing, these things in red here are hazards that we identified in our analysis. This stuff is in yellow is stuff that was additionally identified by community level ground truthing, things that that regulatory databases can miss. Okay, so we have good data, but it's not always great. And so community knowledge combined with some of these official databases can make the cumulative impact screening much better. Same thing, sensitive land uses. The stuff in yellow is what the community ground truthing identified as sensitive land uses that were not captured in the databases that we used. This is about buffers. This is just to show you all the fact that a lot of these sensitive land uses are not significant or not sufficiently buffered away from hazardous land uses. And then we also did some air monitoring in areas of concern near sensitive land uses. This is for PM2.5, and we found that for a lot of the sites, monitoring for a lot of it was exceeding California's ambient air quality standard for PM2.5 in many of those locations. So the takeaways, I think, are that one is I think screening can have a lot of relevance for schools this as a first pass for school siting decision making, not only to identify hazards like the actual facilities, but think about things like air quality, demographics, other things that can make school populations vulnerable to pollution problems. And I think given that we're going to be having to address and adapt to climate change, that we might also want to be considering certain kinds of climate vulnerability indicators when we're siting schools. There are things that are very easy to intervene on, like if you have a lot of impervious surface around, you could use school siting as an opportunity to green the location around it to protect from heat island effects when kids are spending a lot of time. This is the coverage we have right now in California. We're starting to move up and address Sacramento. By the time we're done, we hope to have about 95% to 97% of California's population covered. And I'm going to end there because I've been yakking too long, but I just want to thank my collaborators. All right, thank you.
Thank you.